And again, welcome. So I don't like to lose a lot of this gold in the beginning because you're going through some things. And so without any further ado, welcome to the show, everybody. Chris, I'd love you just for a moment to introduce yourself, who you are, and where folks can find you.
Hi, my name is Chris Chiari. I'm the owner of and founder of the 420 Hotels. We're in Denver, Colorado, with our first location. The website is the420hotels.com. That's THE420 hotels with an S.com.
We have a lot to go over today, but I would like to first start out. Congratulations on what you're doing. After talking to you before and seeing what you're doing online and really hearing the origin story of how this came to be, really excited to dive in and to share with our audience what you're doing. Tell us about your origin story. Like where'd you come from? Where'd you start?
A kid from New Jersey, raised in New York City. I love to start there because it says a lot for those of us that have experienced those places in America, that unique urgency of now that was the 80s and 90s in New York that has been lost a little bit in the world we live in, but I'm grateful to have experienced it. You can't see it if you're listening, but there's a Philadelphia jersey in front of me on Dustin. My grandparents were from Philly. I know that town very well. I knew Pete Rose not as the Cincinnati Red Machine, but as that star of Philadelphia. So
Yeah, for and yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yes, it is Sunday when we're recording this, and so I am wearing a Philadelphia Eagles jersey shirt,
I
excuse
had
me,
the
sweatshirt.
decency to swap out my Broncos mug and go with something more benign. Just
All good. So you're growing up in New Jersey in the New York area. So what was your childhood like? Was you running around the city? Like what were you getting into?
In the 80s, two working parents, that puts you in that position of latchkey kid. My parents didn't really build deep relationships, certainly with the other parents in my school. So it was life in the cities. Life in the city can be both extraordinary and enriching. There are elements of that experience that when I go back to New York now, I am not intimidated by a city like New York. There are actually a lot of places in the world that I feel comfortable because I was first through seventh grade in the city of Manhattan in the 80s. I just want to highlight that part. It was a, economically, where the country was, we live in a pretty good world with all of our struggles right now compared to some of the things I remember from the 70s and 80s. And I'm grateful for that. One of the ways the world's extraordinarily different is we're no longer criminalizing cannabis possession and use, and we've transitioned to a world where that's actually part of almost the norm in so many places. Origin story was sitting on stoops in New York City the summer before I left for college. Yes, I'm outing myself for when I consumed, but I want to be honest. It doesn't mean that I condone. It doesn't mean that the business I'm building is trying to encourage. In fact, as we get into some of the details, I really do pride myself on creating safe legal space for 21 plus adults now to consume cannabis. This is the goal. This is the ambition. Origin, I get to college. And I'm sitting there in the peer group of eight, my second day of college. This is now verified. I'm still close with two of the individuals that were in that group of eight. And they tell me this is a quote. They said, when I was asked what I wanted to do when I grew up at 18 years old, I said, quote, "One day I want to make a safe legal place for me and all my friends to smoke pot together." Fast forward, that was 18. I'm now 50. This has been, in some ways, my life's work. Certainly since 2011, I peeled out of everything I was doing professionally, and I made it very clear that whatever I did next, whatever I had touched before that I will go on to touch next, it was going to touch cannabis. And I have held true to that. The core of what I've done from political work, policy work, to business development, to investing in companies, to building a company of my own, to making a film ultimately about the war on drugs with Ice-T, was all done with this through line of cannabis and the normalization and destigmatization of cannabis possession and use. This has been the purpose. This is still the purpose. And I am sitting on the finish line now, seeing it in sight, about to open the world's first legally licensed cannabis lounge attached to a hotel. I know there's friendly out there because I seek it out when I go and travel. I'm a cannabis consumer, 5 to 7 joints a day. I smoke an ounce a week. I'm not going to be shy about that either. And if anyone wants to get in the foot race with me and see who's going to outpace and lap the other, I'll take on that challenge. I know what I do, and I know I do it side by side with cannabis consumption. And again, not going to be shy about that. But this work is, again, the realization of that childhood dream and the execution of all the things I've learned since then. To bring asset, cash flow, and sizzle together in one deal and in a deal for me that, again, fulfills that lifetime pursuit of creating a safe legal place for me and all my friends to smoke pot together. Oh, and the general public as well, because we're a hotel.
Yeah, so you touched on quite a few things there. One, like what
introduction.
That's an amazing introduction. So you mentioned you're a producer, you've been an investor, or you are an investor. You've done several things in your career. But again, this is your dream. This is the thing that you were like, I don't know exactly what it, but there's something there, and I'm gonna get there. Was there any one thing or two or three things, whatever, however many you list in your prior career or careers that you feel like prepared you for this moment of living your dream?
I'll say this. I was very grateful to get exposed to marketing messaging in the capital markets in the irrational exuberance of the late 90s and early 2000s. The level of the market that I was exposed to wasn't always filled with the cleanest of deals, but I had at the core of what we were trying to do were some ethical questions that we asked to kind of purge before we would take on a client, because looking for real deals and looking for businesses looking to build, create, and take advantage of what are the resources in the capital markets to build their dream, that's a viable path to success. Unfortunately, it's sometimes a path littered with a lot of scoundrels. And so I learned on the knee of some really good securities attorneys how to make a deal clean, put the I's, cross the T's, that transparency was core, that being one step ahead on financial transparency is always the right step to be in, because if your ambition and goal is to build a business, put it on the page, share what you're building. And if you really do have a better mousetrap, that business will prove itself on the page and let it grow. And so often what I watched were businesses that got in their own way, thought that the short bursts of success in the near term were long term, was an opportunity to lean in and really build the foundation. And so the lessons that I learned were how often emerging growth companies would come to the table with IP, asset, a real asset, but with a speculative value. And what I was looking for and was always hopeful for were deals that had real estate or real assets at the end of the day that could operate regardless of the success or failure of your new idea. It's core to what I built here with the 420 Hotels. At the end of the day, we're a real estate ownership company that owns operating cash flowing hotel, our first hotel asset. And then our goal is to add and activate underutilized event space by adding the most unique and exciting amenity and hospitality as a way to drive the success of the core business, not replace it, and then open up the opportunity and the door for the unexpected, the wow factor of what a room like this could potentially do. I could lay it out all day long on Performa and make it as rosy as possible. I've always leaned towards being more conservative so that you outperform your expectations. And in the space around cannabis hospitality, anyone who's putting something on a page and pointing to it and saying, this is fact, it's not. And so it's important, especially as we're emerging into this new segment of cannabis, to put good deals, have good plan, have real assets, have real cash flow. These were lessons taught then that I wanted an opportunity to apply in my own life. Sometimes it's hard to find other participants who will buy into all of these pieces. Shortcuts and looking for shortcuts is often the goal for many. Leaning in until the solution is found and then, you know, going from a walk to a run is how you build a deal. Right, disciplines that you don't get unless somebody maybe taught them to you.
When you were coming up with this idea, again, from 18, you had the dream, you didn't know exactly what it looked like. It was fuzzy. When did it start to become clearer, right? Because it's never clear. With any deal, with building of anything, there's always going to be zigs and zags. Was there any inspiration for you from, you know, coffee shops in Amsterdam? Was there anything else that you saw like, oh, this is closer to what I would want to do?
It's time for a magic trick. So at 27 years old, I was out in California. I was doing the marketing messaging for startups. I finally had enough for good health insurance. I went in to get a physical, and the doctor made it very clear he wanted me to go across the street to the dermatologist, where days later they cut a pretty 2A melanoma off my back. If you know where that is, it's serious, but not serious. In 2001, it was considered still pretty serious. And 50 stitches in my back was what they took to take it off. A doctor at the time said, don't make long-term plans. I wish I could tell you better, but you got 5 to 8 years. And I can't deny that having timeline put in front, because when you build businesses, sometimes they take a decade, and I didn't think I had time to commit to anything again. I ended up in South Florida, close to some family, ran for office unsuccessfully a few times, really leaned into the policy side because it was a passion. It was a bucket list item that I absolutely wanted to cross off before my demise. And then it was January of 2011. At that point, I had had 69 moles cut off. I've now had 80. And the doctor said, look, as long as you keep doing this, as long as you keep getting checked, melanoma is the one that starts from the outside in. You're ahead of the curve. Go make a long-term plan. I'll never forget that. 5 weeks later, my house was under contract in Fort Lauderdale, and I was on a flight to Denver the very next day because just randomly looking at what was potentially available as far as real estate in Denver, in March of 2011, this house popped up, this abandoned structure with a fortuitous address of 420. And I can't deny it caught my eye, and it caught my eye enough that I bought a plane ticket and I flew out to Denver so I could stand in front of it and look at it. And so it was early March of 2011, and I was standing on a street corner in Denver in front of this old historic building that looked like a castle. And I pointed up to that property and I said, one day I want to turn you into a marijuana bed and breakfast. That's what I said. And in that moment, and you're right, right? There are zigzags in business, but I actually say this because this is true with this hotel and this was true with the film. A great idea comes to you almost complete. Do you have the patience to unpack it? Do you have the interest in it to keep letting the thought develop once you get your outline on the page? Do you have the perseverance and tenacity to see it through? Because I stood in front of this building and said, one day I'm going to turn you into a marijuana bed and breakfast. And I remember when I was standing in front of it with the first provisional license, a little over 10 years after I had said that, and before, between there, and here's a zig and zag, I missed the property by 2 weeks back in March of 2011. 2 weeks before I closed on the sale of the house in Fort Lauderdale that would have freed up the resources to come and buy this property in Denver, a mother and son team beat me to it and took what at the time was an unused building. And they're the ones who turned it into an operating bed and breakfast. I've turned it into a boutique hotel. That's by adding the tavern open to the public. We have no doilies on the property, which is one of my jokes to the guests. Difference in a boutique hotel is the number of doilies on the property. Not a technical definition, but one that gets a chuckle out of the guests, and hospitality is about, you know, showing people a good time and making them smile. And every now and
then. I'll say this. For those of you who are listening, watching, go to the420hotels.com. And because I think, Chris, when you first told me about this and I had an idea in my mind of what it looked like, and I was like, oh, it's no little, you know, I don't know what came to my mind, maybe like a Days In or something like that. No, but then seeing the property, you're like, my gosh, this is gorgeous. Like you said, it's like it looks like a castle. It looks like a castle.
Urban a castle.
Yeah. So if you're listening or if you're in the car, don't do it right now. Wait till you pull over. But
hotels.com, and you will see a sweeping picture of the entirety of the property, which is a 9-room operating boutique hotel. We do have an active restaurant license, which does the breakfast to the guests, as well as preps and prepares all the food for our tavern. A tavern is in the carriage house on the side. It is open to the public and been operating for about 2.5 years. That was a licensing change I was able to do once I purchased the property. And then if you're looking at the house, on the lower left corner is where we are under construction and are right now building that indoor cannabis lounge.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned about the clarity and what you saw and, you know, like this is it. And do you have the patience of doing that? And when building this, the product that I'm doing, the ranges, the wearable range product, this is the first time, and I'm 44 years old at this time. This is the first time in my adult life, in my career, that I've had something so clear, like, no, this is what it is. This is what it does. And yeah, there are people that will say things like, oh, it could do this too. And they're like, yeah, okay, they can be on the roadmap. Like that, we'll consider that.
How far did I throw that reel?
It's just unbelievable what you can do, or what just the feeling of having that clarity and to work through. It powers you, tapping into that powers you through so much adversity, and it forces you to have the patience, and I don't know, it's just, so when you said that, you really tapped into something that I've just recently have learned.
And it feels good, doesn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. There's nothing like it. And
the experience of building. It's the creative side.
It is.
You know, the last thing I learned from those people all those years ago, my mentors, let's say, coming up through the years, is focus as much time as you can on building things, not tearing them apart. Right? I love entertainment lawyers and securities attorneys. The rest of them sometimes, ugh.
So I want to, because sorry about that sidetrack there. I just want to put a pin in what you were saying, because it resonates deeply with me. And I'm not sure about the years of legalization in the different areas and different places. So you said 2011 was
when? Yeah, 2011, we had the emergence of medical cannabis in states like Colorado, which had happened several years before. You already had the emergence of dispensaries that really started to pop up in L.A. right there after 2000, certainly by 2006. You started to see it by the Cole Amendment in 2008. That's it. Cannabis was pretty much very available in a number of places across the country where there was movement towards medical and inklings towards ultimately recreational. I sold my house in Fort Lauderdale. I missed out on the property, and I ended up on a road trip. A guest at the hotel, when I told him, who from Australia, when I told him it was a walkabout, he said, "Oh yeah, why do you think it was a walkabout?" I said, "It was a trip with no destination in mind, no length of time it would last as long as it lasted. And the through line was to discover and learn everything I could about cannabis, something that I had been a consumer of for quite some time at that point, but its production, distribution, networks that had, you know, given me access since 17, I had a real curiosity and almost felt an obligation to expose myself to it and learn something before I moved to Colorado, a state that it looked like there were going to be chances to invest in the not too distant future. Of course, legalization doesn't pass till 2012. Happens November 2012. I was actually in Denver the very next day. There was a cannabis conference in town. I made some relationships and connections, some of which I still have to this day. And then I hopped on a plane and flew to Amsterdam, where I spent 2 weeks on the first leg, went to Berlin, southern Italy, to see family, and then back up into Amsterdam, where I spent 2 weeks interning in the gray area. I don't know if you know the limits, but I was, for a couple of weeks, engaged in carrying and moving what might have been questionable amounts to facilitate what is the gray area of illegal production and distribution to licensed cannabis cafes that exists throughout the city and across the Netherlands. It's a really convoluted system that many people don't understand. They assume that it's legal, and it's not. It is tolerated. So what we're doing in places like California, Washington, and Colorado are significantly further along than anything that's ever been tried as far as the experiment of cannabis in the Netherlands. And that
really?
Is a reality. Yes. And that's a reality that most people don't realize. There was just a musician, she got busted with over 5 grams trying to leave the airport, because in the Netherlands, you may purchase up to 3 grams at a time at a coffee shop. You do not have to consume it there, but that's good form. You can then possess no more than 5 grams. After that, you're right back into weight. And then the Netherlands has only recently started moving towards what is sanctioned or licensed cultivation. There are a handful of cultivators. It's an experiment that's going to probably prove successful because they need to move there, and that's what's happening. But for most of legal cannabis in the Netherlands, that was product grown in apartments on the outskirts of town and using bicycles and trains with your monthly train pass, was moved by people in packages in bulk to safe houses. The safe houses were then used because you can only possess up to 500 grams at a time inside of a licensed coffee shop, no more. You think about that, it's a little over a pound. It's a decent amount of product, but if you want to have any type of variety, if you want to have any type of control of inventory, you can't just have 500 grams. And so an entire economy exists in what is very commonly known as the gray area that we do not have. Yes, we still have legacy in this country, and I have consumed legacy for a long time, and I will never disparage or push back, but I am enticed by and excited by lanes of legality and have been leaning into that now for well over a decade. Cannabis hospitality, in my case, is a bring your own. So I actually create a space for caregivers and other cultivators that are making at home product to still be able to bring it in and smoke in my lounge. It's one of the places that'll make my space different from others. Where you sourced it is not my business. The fact that you have it, you're welcome to consume it. And that was core to what we're trying to offer here as far as an amenity.
You mentioned being on the policy side when you, even before all of this, and you were in Florida and understanding that, and then you're traveling and you're learning about that, and you're learning about the business of it, you know the policy of it.
Policy on cannabis in Florida. I want to make one thing clear.
Excuse me. I thought that was the policy that you were.
No. When I was running for office, one of the topics I never touched was the fact that it was cannabis, because I was a consumer.
Ah,
and since I was hiding that consumption, the only thing that I've had to hide and lie about in my life has been that I am a cannabis consumer. That's why I won't do that anymore. Wherever I can and I can have it on me, I always have a dugout in my pocket and a one-hitter in my pocket. I don't bring it into schools when I go there for community meetings or things like that. But other than that, if I'm walking down the street, that's in my pocket. And it's something that is core to my life, and I will never hide again. For a stage of my life, I actually felt the time that I was running for office in the early 2000s, the most effective cannabis advocates on a policy side back then were most likely non-consumers. Because once you outed yourself as supporting that policy, or you outing yourself as a consumer, you needed to have at least the moral high ground to defend yourself. So no, that was not my issue. My issue was hurricane insurance and blue tarps on roofs. My issue was aid to seniors along the coast in South Florida. One of my issues was whether or not a natural gas degasification facility 15 miles offshore was a good idea or not. Won't go into specifics on any of that, but those were the types of issues I was focused
on.
Got it.
Well, shame on me for assuming.
But I love policy. So yeah. The second I said that whatever I was going to do with the next chapter of my life, I leaned in. I went to my first Normal meeting. I met Keith Stroop, the founder of Normal, who became one of the subjects of the documentary I made. Made the policy important when I moved to Colorado and they said I couldn't smoke in my yard. I put on a tie and showed up at a city council meeting. From there, I ended up very heavily involved in some of the local politics. My state rep, I served as the chair of his district for almost 4 years. And I did that with my dugout in my pocket. Because for me, it was doing work that I loved on a multitude of issues, cannabis being one of them in core, but also being able to function in society, participate in society, contribute to community, and do all of that as a cannabis consumer while owning a business and being a homeowner. That all the things that it was assumed that if you smoke cannabis, you'd have none of these things, you can do none of these things. Not only did I do it, but I do it with a cloud of the odor de cannabis on me at every turn.
So, okay, thank you for clarifying that. So now what you're doing, and I'd love to in a minute talk about all the different things that you have to do as far as the HVAC systems, you know, the air conditioning and the controls there. I'd love to talk about that. But do you feel, because they're shifting policy, you know, this is relatively new to be put out there. Do you feel like the goalposts are staying somewhat still as you're maneuvering through this process? Or are there things that specifically that you're like, well, they're saying I need to do this, but now I got to do that. Like, what's your experience right now?
I ran into a little bit of that. But, you know, politics is a game you play. It's a contact sport, right? And so that experience of being exposed to it has helped as I've navigated some of the challenges. You know, I ran into that at first, but there is international standard and code under this thing called ASHRAE. And in ASHRAE, there is IAQ, or indoor air quality standards. And you're in California. So anyone in California of a certain age is going to remember when everyone used to smoke everywhere. I was in New York. Everyone used to smoke everywhere, bars, restaurants, and elevators. And then one day they said you couldn't do that anymore. And about a year later, all of a sudden you could again. And then about a year later, you couldn't. And we've never been able to do it since. And what happened was the Clean Indoor Air Act, which was an initiative by California and New York, which said that employee protection is the responsibility of a business owner. And in the case of a smoke-filled room, at first they said there was no safe exposure level. Ultimately, international standards did establish a path for new cigar lounges. That's why you see them periodically open. And now it's guiding us and giving us a path for cannabis hospitality. I'm not worried about the standard going higher because we are executing an HVAC system that meets the highest standard. I'm not worried about that design not being usable because in Nevada, where the standard is half, in Denver, we're at 60 CFM, 60 cubic feet of air per minute per person. And so I want you to think of a box that's 20 foot by 20 foot by 20 foot per person per minute. That's the amount of air per person that I have to exchange in the room and replace. It's an extraordinary volume. Nevada and Las Vegas have that standard set at 30 CFM, which means my current design, I could just double the occupancy of the room, but the design stays the same. And so it becomes a scalable tool that we've created, which is one of our IP elements is the HVAC system. Now it's, we've done so many things unique in how we've stacked and brought inline filtration and air exchange, how we've gotten concessions from the city that give us amendments towards efficiency. I'm proud to say now that we have an HVAC system that is not just applicable to this, but scalable to other locations. And that's core, right? When you're building out a business model, having pieces that scale with you become important and valuable.
Were there any other things throughout this process that surprised you, or at least you didn't anticipate? You're like, wow, okay. I mean, I guess I have to do that, but I didn't see that coming.
I have a liquor license, part of the hotel. So I've navigated that regulatory process. I held paramutual licenses, horse racing in Florida, New York, West Virginia, and California. And if in each of those jurisdictions, some have reciprocity. But so I've gone through the Department of Revenue and been fingerprinted in California and Florida and gone through that application process with background check and have been in a space where you have to wear a badge prominently displayed on the outside of whatever you're wearing if you are in a regulated portion of that business, like where the horses are behind the track, not in the stands. So when I came into cannabis, none of that was surprising. Maybe what's so surprising is there are still a lot of cannabis participants that are saying, regulate us like alcohol. And I'm telling them we are pretty close. And OSHA's now in Colorado investigating all the cannabis operators. So there you go. Another place we have become pretty normal, a normal business that we are now being regulated mostly towards employee safety. It's becoming a real issue in cannabis because we've operated in state-regulated bodies with no national standards. Many of these operators are good operators that have created SOPs and will be able to implement reasonable changes towards employee protections. Others are still working out of outdated facilities, with, you know, electrical wiring running across floors that have puddles on them. You see this every now and then, and it's still a reality, not just in every level of cannabis and from employee safety. In my case, it's about air quality. It's about making sure that employees have a flight to safety or a place to do most of their work that isn't in a smoky room.
One of the things that really jumps out to me recently, you know, again, it's Sunday, I'm watching football. When I see it now and you see how many gambling, and I'm going somewhere with this, trust me. So they're like, you know, the DraftKings and the FanDuel, there's so many out there. And it's just like, wait, wasn't gambling just illegal? Yesterday, it just amazes me how quickly things change and all of a sudden it's like everywhere. And that's why when I went back to asking about like when it became legal, like now most places, and I know in San Diego where I am, like you smell it all the time. And like it's, and now it's like, well, now there's gambling everywhere. I feel like you're the tip of the spear with what you're doing though, with like having this hotel, this location. Do you see this becoming a big thing quickly, or is this something that you're like, well, it still has another 5 or 10 years?
Always 5 or 10 years, always 5 or 10 years away. But now we are on the cusp of some of these things. Certainly, we're 10 years now into, plus a regulated market in Colorado. We are certainly 2.5 years now into with space for these cannabis lounge policies where some places are opening up. But the places that are opening up right now in Denver, specifically in the city, still are outside consumption areas, because everyone is still navigating this final hurdle of getting that HVAC system. We're actually days away from right now from the city chief engineer giving us a yay or nay on our current permit. We're past working with the city on design. We are in permit now. But the good news is mechanically, my system does everything it needs to. Plus, if anything, the city's going to have me change or increase the amount of outside air that I've reduced to cycle through the room. Again, that's where I'm picking up efficiency by recirculating and filtering air. That's the only thing they might make us change. And that's a setting at installation that is not a redesign of the system. So as far as getting a system, we know we can execute and get through this. We have that. Now it's what setting will they like us to have it on when we turn it on is the only thing left to be decided. Look, Denver never wanted to be first at any of this, but has always found itself first because it is the big city in the state that did this, yes, with Washington, but Colorado went a different path in some of the regulations and really tried to move this in Department of Revenue, move this into proven bureaucracy. And by and large, I personally feel that it has been successful. But let's talk about San Diego, because we had the same thing here, right? You can smell cannabis basically anywhere. Little less now in Denver as we've gotten so far into this. But a lot of that are cannabis consumption lounges or cannabis-friendly options that are now starting to emerge. Gavin Newsom has just recently signed cannabis hospitality into law in the state of Colorado and state of California. And now let's talk about what that means. Everyone operating now right now is carving out, usually in an outside patio space, a safe place. But California has not embraced what New York said, where you can smoke cannabis anywhere you can smoke a cigarette. Can't really smoke a cigarette anywhere in New York, certainly not in a bar or a restaurant. Maybe you can sneak it on a rooftop patio, but still you're sneaking it, right? It's not condoned or allowed. And so even in this world where it's happening where it can be friendly. It's happening where no licensed environment exists yet, but now California has passed the law. Now California's cannabis board is going to create rulemaking. That rulemaking then is going to be adopted by or applied or added on by each of the major cities, and all of them will take their stab at it, because that's what this has happened with dispensary licensing and every evolution as we've moved from legacy to legal. I'm going to say this, I'm not Nostradamus, but I have to believe that it's not unreasonable to predict that the state that created the Clean Indoor Air Act is going to apply the Clean Indoor Air Act to cannabis hospitality for any indoor operating business, and is likely still going to license what that outside looks like. How far is it away from a school? That very reason, you're going to smell it. How far is it away from a daycare, from a community center? These were the restrictions in Colorado. How far from another license like its type? So if you have two lounges side by side, one of them might get first to that licensing window and the other then might get forced to close. So these are the major uncertainties that exist in California, but I'm excited for it because it's right on pace with my development time. My business model is not to create a cannabis lounge solution for everybody. Other participants are experimenting with their models. My responsibility is to create a good business that has core ingredients that allow it potentials for success, even with great unknowns. And my expansion model is to focus on operating boutique hotels where we activate underutilized or unutilized event space by bringing in our proprietary HVAC system. And then as a convenient to overnight, adding an on-site consumption lounge. Cannabis lounges are a wonderful place to go from lunch to sometime after dinner. And these businesses, likely whether they have food or beverages, are going to attract an audience. It's especially in high velocity markets like Las Vegas, where the movement of new people is very high. For me, I believe I offer three joint opportunities, three smoking opportunities that no other cannabis lounge will offer. And that's the one when you check in and it's time to relax. It's the one before you go to bed because of its convenience to your pillow. And it's the one before you leave for the airport. And so what I believe is that for cannabis hospitality to work, it needs to be so convenient to a successful business and part of that successful business, so that investors aren't thinking that just having a room there next to someone else is going to work for them. It has to be part of the whole pie. Music venues, most people take two hits. Let's talk about how people consume cannabis. Most consumers, even frequent consumers, are two, three, four hits. They're hanging out on the couch on a Saturday night waiting for the movie to start with their partner or significant other. They're at a friend's backyard barbecue. They're sitting on the porch with a friend. They're taking two hits before they go into the music venue. And maybe they take two more when the joint gets passed in during the show. But by and large, that's many consumers. And each of those consumption points all happen at a place that you already identified. You don't need to go to a lounge for it. And then for those of us that smoke more frequently, I know where most of my 5 to 7 are smoked. Yes, I might be that audience that would go to the lounge instead of a bar every now and then. But the question will be, how big is that market? And that's another uncertainty. I'm staying away from that uncertainty by building intimate space attached to an intimate hotel and making it a convenient amenity that makes the rest of the business offering, the food, the alcohol, and the overnight hospitality, more appealing, increasing awareness, therefore increasing occupancy and average daily rate. That's the business.
So I'd love to talk about your expansion model and how you're thinking about, you know, short-term, mid-term, long-term. Are there certain things that you're seeing now with the development that you're saying, okay, if we scale this, we need to look for X or Y in the next one? I know not to get too far away from what you're currently doing, because again, it's important to focus on the here and now and what you're doing now. But I also think it's important to learn lessons, and you're saying, you know what else would be cool? Like for our next one is to have, you know, a little more space or a bigger square footage in this area. Is there anything like that that's part of your expansion?
100% there's core, no specific, because right now I have this focus on executing this first to market. I'm on the cusp of being the first hotel licensed like this, licensed to bring the legitimacy of indoor cannabis consumption to a property. Friendly, again, is out there, prolific. You see it in the news, but this is licensed. And the value of that is from that expansion point, building a hotel model. Cannot build a hotel model on just being friendly. You can build a hotel model on legitimate businesses that literally dotted the I's and crossed the T's. And that's the goal here. So what am I looking for? First and foremost, I know that getting through a mature bureaucracy like Denver with a unique HVAC system that provides this space for indoor cannabis consumption and employee safety and protection is scalable, because Denver enforced the highest standards of these rules. And other jurisdictions, also like Denver, didn't want to be first. But once we're first, I'm excited to go into a city council meeting in San Diego once the state has moved through their rulemaking. And as we move into the rezoning of a property or acquisition of a property, I look forward to making that case of, here is our system that works. What setting would you like me to put it on for outside air mix? Because that's what we have. For me, it's operating hotels that are right-sized to the market. I do not believe that a 200-room hotel in any major city putting in a cannabis lounge is going to, they could hurt their business as much as help it. So for me, it's about making sure that you are the right size so that if the concept catches on, you have that potential through added less access, makes it more exclusive and appealing. Exclusivity is a value driver in higher end luxury hospitality. And so it speaks to the model. If our properties are too small, then we end up with that ability to elevate the experience. I said it to my GM, who's been with me 5.5 years when he started. He said, do you want to cut the prices and be more competitive with the surrounding businesses? I said, no, I want us to raise the price. And then I want you and I to define what is value for that price. And when we hit that and find that point, then we reinvest in bringing more value to the experience. That's luxury hospitality, right? Sure. The difference of what might be a Days Inn model, where it's about turning over the beds, where me, it's about turning over a bed while elevating the experience.
Oh, amazing. What's next for you? Like, what are you looking for from, you know, investors, from folks that want to be involved? Is there anything specific? Like, what's your ask of people that hear this and they're like, wow, that's cool. I want to be involved. Like, how can I get in to be a part of this?
We're doing a round that likely closes very soon. And so right now we're not, other than the capital raise that I'm on the cusp of either closing or adding a little bit more to, we're there. I've identified the resources to build this lounge and we are under construction right now. What I've always known is that my next ask really has to come from once this is finished. But I said at the beginning where my background was, this business was built to move to the capital markets. I haven't done a reverse merger. I'm not part of a blank check company. There are no restrictions on shares. This is a C corp designed from its inception to move, sell equity based upon assets and value and cash flow while building a business and ultimately laying the foundations to scale and expand that business. I strongly believe that once we open this lounge, the ability to communicate with traditional hospitality investment will mature in a way it just can't until it's open. Still just an idea. I'm operating a hotel. I'm operating a tavern. I've got these things licensed and in existence, but its actual ribbon cutting will be a significant day, because you know hospitality, and in hospitality, once you can define something unique about your model, once you can show that you have defined a masthead or a brand, once you've shown that you have created a culture that's unique to your product, a guest experience that's unique to your product, and then add something that really makes you stand out, the resources and ability to pull the funding needed to start bundling hotels is realized. This model is proven, but how many people ever cross that threshold of bundling enough properties or rooms or a unique amenity to stick out, to rise enough above to be seen, and then the risk? Cannabis is this exciting new frontier. But cannabis hospitality right now is littered with a number of concepts with leased space located next to vice, usually strip clubs and sharing parking lots, that has gotten stuck, still being that thing we don't want to talk about, pushed to the side. And my product is right in the heart of town. My product is this historic castle with curb appeal, an 1893 building with a history long before I ever got there that I'm not going to rewrite, but I might add a chapter to. The building had a fortuitous address of 420. It is suitable and so far enough away from any other restrictions. And then the last piece is I'm finding that path to have food, beverage being alcohol, overnight, and cannabis hospitality, not in the same room, which we're not there yet. No one's there yet, but at least on the same property, where guests of the hotel, guests of private events will be able to experience each of those. As far as expansion, yes, bigger opportunities, bigger properties will likely create a cannabis lounge, a storefront or footprint that will be more accessible both to the outside as well to the hotel guests. This property does, you know, you have to execute with the limitations of what is in front of you. But the added gains and advantages of this property, again, the curb appeal, the address, the location, the licensing, I always say it's the right size for the risk I'm taking right now. Do you risk putting cannabis lounge in a 200-room hotel if you don't think a cannabis lounge is going to help a 200-room hotel? No. But will a cannabis lounge materially influence or change the occupancy of a 9-room hotel? Without question. And do I have a property? Do I have an address? And do I have some IP that's scalable to other locations? I believe that's also without question. And I'll let the market and investors tell me whether that's true or not.
And you're at the intersection. If I could, in my mind, there's this Venn diagram. And I know it's not just these three, but it's the business, it's hospitality, it's cannabis. And you're in this, you know, the overlapping concentric part of the circles there. And Are you involved with any organizations or trade groups? I know I work in commercial real estate, so I go to a lot of, you know, the BOMA, NAIOP, SIO. I go to these conferences, and I love going to them because there's so many ideas that are floating around and what people are doing. You're talking to people that are, if you're in all of these different areas, is there anybody that you're associated with, or you go to these conferences and talk about it, whether it's cannabis conference, hospitality conference, any of those things?
I was invited to talk at a hotel conference when the news first came out about the lounge. But until it's open, right, there hasn't been any more of that, because really it's that reality, right? It's just an idea. And ideas are wonderful. Some guy got on CNN one time because he was going to do a cruise ship with cannabis right there at the birth of legalization. They were going to leave from Seattle. And they never asked the guy if he had a boat, which he didn't, or if he had talked to a cruise ship company, which he hadn't yet. Because at the end of the day, you can't bring the drugs onto the, well, you're not supposed to bring the drugs on because it is crossing a federal border. So they did have that issue. And so, you know, I there's a lot of ideas floating around. There's a concept here in town, a lot of ideas, a lot of excitement, and a really beautiful render and a concept that I hope works, because all cannabis hospitality succeeding will bring a new audience in for me to attract to my 9-room hotel. So I love that. And any cannabis lounge open from, you know, 10 a.m. till midnight, they're all going to close at night. I close at night, but I also make most of my money when I'm closed at night. People are sleeping in their pillows. So another place I'm trying to de-risk the uncertainty of cannabis hospitality. But, you know, it's the Wild West. You know what the Wild West is? It's littered with unknowns. It's littered with models that fail. And all of us that are looking to execute business models in the space, I would say, have a responsibility to bring a deal to the table that has more substance than just this lounge is going to work. Because in my case, if the lounge ever proves unsuccessful, I will turn that into a cigar lounge in a weekend and get back to serving scotch in there. But I am determined and strongly believe that I already have space for alcohol, that adding space for cannabis is a value add. And as far as the outreach, look, the cannabis conferences, we have a ton of them. I have definitely done that circuit. But for the last 9 months, I have been focused right on the business, on getting what is now an HVAC system into final permitting that we believe we are going to get approved on. We have already started construction. So all of those pieces, the backside of opening this lounge, I look forward to every invite. I'll accept the ones I can, but I have spent, here's the challenge. I'm real estate, I'm liquor and hotels. These are post-revenue cash flow. So many cannabis investments are in emerging markets now, like New Jersey, still in Ohio. So much of cannabis investment is still looking at vertically integrated grow, thinking that Colorado performance models are going to hold up, and they're not. Now, I'm going to tell you why they're not holding up. Long before we legalized cannabis in this country, we didn't have a production problem. We had a possession and use problem. We had a distribution problem. So growing and adding more indoor cultivation is not necessarily what the market needs right now. The market needs more places for people to normalize its consumption. And that's what we're missing. So much of that investment. So traditional hotel is scared of cannabis. They freak out, forcing me into hard money lenders. And then traditional hospice, right? So hospitality won't touch cannabis, and traditional cannabis now, which we actually have from an investment standpoint, can't wrap their minds around hospitality because they don't understand the sale of pillows. Unless that's a pillow or pound of weed. Mm. 5 bag pound of weed, which was commonly known as a pillow.
Oh, really? Okay. Makes sense. I don't know the weight.
My sister used my pillows.
Okay. That's amazing. So I got another question for you because we're almost out of time, but I have to touch on this because you mentioned the movie, or we talked about a little bit, the movie that you produced. And I'm really intrigued, and maybe that's for another episode or we can dive into that. But what in that process did you learn from producing a film? Like what was that? You were like, I need to do this, or I have this idea. I want to do it. Like, what was that opportunity and how did that
storytelling get executed? I was around creative people in my mid to late 20s when right before the melanoma diagnosis. I was actually working with a friend of mine who was the editor, and we were producing and directing shorts going all the way back to 1999, 2000, 2001, a short digital content exercising. So it was always in the back of my mind, but entertainment, storytelling, narrative, these are things that take commitment. You know, you don't come up with an idea and it becomes a product tomorrow. You come up with an idea and it even the best of films takes several years. And when a doctor told me I had 5 to 8 years to go, I didn't see the space to grow there. I didn't see the time that I could commit to mature. Stanislavski says 20 years of doing something to get good at it, 30 years to master. And when someone says you got 5 to 8, you may have 20 to get good at it. So I went off into the pursuit of life experience, to lap around the world. I ran for office. I had the ability to take what became the means going from minimum wage jobs to getting maybe lucky, again, in the irrational exuberance of the late 90s, and not enough to break free for life. Right, I work, but enough to, for that window, chase anything. So that was the greatest gift I ever got in life, to not have to chase. Well, second greatest gift. The greatest gift was that clean bill of health in January 2011, because of the perspective that I could commit to something again. Why did I make the film? Because it was getting back to where my heart was. I made the film because I had the privilege and ability to lean into relationships I had developed with some significant individuals within cannabis and cannabis reform, like Keith Stroop and Ethan Nadelman, that network, there was a story to be told. And I had the idea. I wanted to tell and follow and track public opinion from 1970 at 12% to where it was at the time we started the film, which was only 54% on national polls, and see if federal drug policy correlated or deviated from the growth of public opinion. And in fact, there are very striking inflection points that were almost surprising that the public has always, been affected by ultimately became drug policy, but persevered over time and has matured as recognizing that cannabis is relatively benign, certainly as it relates and compares to alcohol, that work of Mason Trevert and the other ones here in Colorado around SAFER, or really focusing on cannabis reform as analogous to alcohol. It was transformative in the policy. And so for me, capturing that, and also there was a real push. You know, Georgia is a state where most men in that state, certainly black men in the state of Georgia, one third, according to a movie called 13th, have been affected by the process or the system. And one third of the men in that demographic in the state of Georgia have lost a right to vote because of a prior felony. This is the worst part of drug policy in America, was that it really was used as a political tool. It wasn't just a criminal justice tool. It was a political tool. Because if you can deny an individual a right to participate through something they exhaled, speech, freedom of speech, we have the freedom of speech. Your speech is free until that speech has weed smoke coming out of your mouth along with it. And it was fascinating. And so please watch Public Enemy Number One. Penofilm.com is the website, penofilm.com. But Public Enemy Number One, you can rent it on Amazon or you can stream it with commercials on Pluto TV.
I'm going to have links to your hotel, to your profile, to the movie on the show notes. So everything will be included there. So I guess my question deeper into this, did you know a lot of this going into the film and saying like, I know this and I want to put this out there? Or were you knew a little bit about it and then you wanted to, and then you wanted to explore it and learn through the process?
I had a body of knowledge, but it's my project. So I sat for all 44 hours of unique interviews with a camera right over my shoulder as we made this film. So that was 44 hours of some of the greatest minds in the space from all different sides of both pro and con, sharing those views and perspectives and doing it. Give me one second. Lawn care. It's a Sunday. So I was absolutely enriched by that and certainly informed through that process. On the other side, when I started my road trip in 2011, when I started that walkabout, when I got into my car and started that drive, a trip that lasted 115,000 miles over 22 months and did end with me moving to Denver. When I started that trip, I knew that cannabis was the female plant of the cannabis sativa. I knew that hemp and cannabis were considered cousins, but that was about the extent of it. I knew that Northern Lights got me stuck in the couch. And Sour Diesel from a grower I knew in New York, that was a pretty stimulating strain, but it also had a lot of odor. You didn't want to get caught in the subway with that bag. I had a turkey bag one time, that seal popped on that bag. I went two stops and I walked the rest of that way back uptown. It was a long walk, but there was no other option.
What's a turkey bag?
A turkey baster bag. No, the freezer bags where people...
I thought it was slang.
No. So literally I had a QP one time in my bag in New York City, and the seal went on one of those ounces, and it was the eyes. It was the way people were staring at me on the train. I just knew. So I remember the picture of Homer going into the tree.
Yeah.
That door opened the next stop, and I just slid right off that train and walked 80 blocks to my destination.
Well, I learned a couple of things. One, I reverse learned turkey bag and also pillow. Didn't know that was, but makes sense. So you've been very gracious with your time. This has been a lot of fun to learn about you and your journey and what you're doing. Is there anything else that you want to leave our audience with today? And again, because you mentioned a lot of things about, you know, the timing and what you're doing. The audience listening, this is 2024, late October, and we'll get this episode out as soon as possible. But leaving our audience with anything, is there anything you'd want to say and leave us with?
Yeah, keep an eye out. This is going to happen fast. It's going to happen over the next couple of months, and I'm excited to bring it to market. You know, the news cycle was very supportive of the idea. I'm hopeful it's also very excited about the execution and the ribbon cutting. And then keep an eye out, because I intend to expand this to major 5-star cities around the country.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much. Extremely impressed. And again, for all of those listening, go to the website, the 420 hotels, the number 4, the number 2, the number 0, hotels.com. It is an actual, absolutely beautiful establishment, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
And yeah, I'll be following. I'll be watching. I'll see what we can make happen.
I appreciate that.